Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today and next week, our special guest is Bill Shipp. Bill has been one of the largest wholesale buyers of real estate in Riverside for many years. He has a unique system that can even be done from a distance, which he proves every day by living in another state. Bill, welcome to our show.
Good afternoon, Bruce.
Welcome back, actually.
Welcome back. That's right.
And
about a year now.
Yeah, and just so you know, you were really one of the bigger hits. We had a lot of very knowledgeable investors pretty enthralled with your system.
So that's good.
That was fun.
All right.
When you can impress the guys that do it every day, that's a good thing. How long have you been buying real estate?
Well, full-time since 86. And dabbled in it a little bit in the early 70s. Just did a little five-unit apartment building in Long Beach. I bought it as a rental one time, and I found out I could sell it and make more money than keeping it as a rental. So I sold it.
Okay.
And before that, the first property I ever bought was a little lot in Quail Valley outside of Canyon Lake. I think we talked about that last time.
Okay.
I actually bought it from a family member. Had it a few years and saw that I could sell that and make more money than what I paid for it, and that was pretty exciting.
Now, why the gap then between the 70s and the 86?
Well, I went to the work for the corporate world.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
I worked at U.S. Suzuki for about 6 years. Worked my way up to be distribution manager. And then I quit that and went to work for a logistics company down in Long Beach and was over millions of square foot of warehouse and inventory and in charge of distribution and trucking. And that's when my friend told me about real estate in 1986 and told me to take a week's vacation. And I did that boot camp. We talked about that last time. So I did the boot
camp. Well, no one's going to remember that. But
I'm going to tell you again.
No. You need to do it again.
Okay.
Boot camp. I didn't even know there was a boot camp in the mid-80s.
Yes, there was.
Whose was that?
That was with a gentleman named Al LaPeter. And he worked out of Bellflower, and he was really heavy into buying the VA repos and the HUD repos back when they used to, in fact, on the VAs are up to 7% commission.
That's right.
You can buy them as an investor with 10% down. So after the commission and buying them, you're in it a whole 3%. And that's what started me in the rental business. And I ended up buying quite a few of those.
And okay.
At my peak, I think I had 42 rentals. And now I have one.
Okay.
Took me a long time to sell them in the 90s when it was really hurting everybody.
Okay.
And so I didn't like rentals in the 90s. And so anyway, I did my boot camp for a week with him, and he convinced me that I should quit my corporate world. Wasn't even making six figures at that time, but I was responsible for a lot of people, a lot of inventory. And you don't have any type of... you could be fired at any day. You don't know.
Yeah.
They could be bought out and transferred or whatever. And I really liked the idea of being your own boss and having all the inventory in Southern California at your that you could get a hold of. And inventory cost was nothing until you owned it.
Anybody in your tight circle look at that decision and go, Bill's lost it?
Yeah, especially the people that I worked for.
You're going to do what?
Yeah, I literally did the boot camp and went back in and gave my notice, gave my two-week notice. And, I had a company car and all the benefits. And I just said, I'm going to start real estate. And that's exactly what I did. So I quit and started selling.
What's interesting about it's always interesting to me when people get into the business because it's sort of, I don't know, it gives them a certain bent on – you think, okay, this is how things work. Now, when you get an 86, 86 to 89 was a heck of a run.
It was a great run.
Yeah, that was even one of those things where if you touched a property, it would be tough to make a mistake. Prices were escalating really quick, and interest rates were not reasonable, but they sure were more reasonable than 80 and 81.
I think there were 8% at that time.
Okay. And when I got into it in 81, I refied my house at 17.5.
Right. Yeah.
And that tainted how I looked at real estate. It really did, because it wasn't one of those things that you could cash flow. You had to touch and let it go.
Right.
I mean, there was no way to finance that stuff and make it work.
No. It's in 86, again, when I was getting a 7% commission and then only having to put 10% down, I was able to buy a lot of houses. Same thing happened in like 05, 06, and 07. Everybody thought the answer was buying rentals or flipping or whatever, and they're buying houses. Money was pretty available with that No income, no sign, no whatever to get a loan. And so that's what I did. And I was very excited about it. I was seeing my net worth go up. I was having some positive cash flow off of it. And then when 90 hit, and then I was like, wait a minute, now I have a negative cash flow, and my houses are down $30,000 a house.
You know, times 40.
So I lost about $1 million in net worth at that time.
Okay.
And fortunately, I had friends that were still thought that was a good time to buy in the early 90s. And so they bought like half of my houses, took 50% of it. And that was able to keep me alive.
So you're able to keep the rest of it.
Keep the rest of it. You know, surround yourself with successful people. And sometimes they can help you out when they see an opportunity. And they saw the opportunity and bought half of my houses from me. Not, they didn't buy half, they went in 50% partners.
Oh, okay, so they just kind of infused your world with some liquidity.
Yeah, and with some liquidity, and of course it helped on the negative cash flow because, you know, now instead of the $300 to $400 a month, now it's down at $150 a month, and it was doable.
Well, you know, I guess one thing that impressed me is that's creative. I mean, I don't think many people would just go, okay, how do I extricate myself and still have properties? I mean, you kind of found a way to do that. And that probably, you probably found money partners that may not exactly have had the same skill as you did. You found good stuff.
Well, these were my corporate friends.
Okay.
You know, that people are, their accountants or financial planners are saying, you should buy real estate now. It's down. You can have the write-offs. And it was just an easy win-win for them. And, so now I had good money behind me.
Yeah.
And my other option was to walk from them.
Yeah.
And which a lot of people did. And I didn't. And I'm glad because still to this day, I got this great credit score where I can go out and get financing at any time I want.
Yeah.
And if I had let them go, I probably still could have got financing, but I would have been getting charged a lot.
Yeah.
In fact, talking about I did do hard money loans when I first started flipping. When I was really into full-time flipping was like 88, 89, I remember paying 13% in 3 to 5 points.
Yeah, that's still normal.
I think it might have then been 15% in 3 to 5 points.
Oh, back then, maybe, though.
Yeah, but I thought that was pretty high, but it worked.
Yeah, if you have access to money and the profits there, it really doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what your interest rate is or your points. It's when you look at it and you're done with it, if you've made money on it, it's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you get started in 1986, Bill Shipp is not a household name, and it is now. So how did that transition gradually occur?
Well, I went to work for an office in Riverside. Actually, I left my friend that taught me everything in Bellflower, and I went to work in Riverside because that's where the houses were.
Okay.
At the time, I was living down in Newport Beach and driving to Riverside and looking at houses, and I thought, well, I need to make a move. So I moved to Riverside where it was in my backyard to look at the houses, and I actually started as a real estate agent selling to investors.
Okay.
To some of my corporate friends I was talked about. I sold houses to them.
So they were not buy-sell people, they were buy-hold people.
They're buy and hold and some sell.
Okay.
They were flipping some, and that's how I'd done it a couple before, had flipped, and then I was seeing all the money they were making, and I said, okay, I'm not going to work with clients anymore, and I just started buying full-time for myself. And But my name got out when I was in Riverside as an agent, you know, because I was buying the HUD and VA repos and talking to different agents. And then I started talking to the agents that if they found something, I would buy it from them, let them represent me. And I just started from there.
Okay.
And then I started really promoting myself by actually going to real estate offices and giving talks to their offices and promoting myself.
I would think, I remember sending a flyer, and it had to be in the 90s because I was buying a fair amount of properties, and I had actually calculated how much agents had made on me in commission, but it wasn't an organized plot. It was just it happened, okay? And
right.
I thought, I need to do the same kind of thing. I did a flyer, and it said, okay, last year realtors made, and it was ridiculous, $300,000-something on my transactions. I'd like to do some more of that. And so 1,200 of those flyers went into everybody's slot. You know how many phone calls I got? None.
That's because maybe they called me. I had the same flyer going.
Well,
but I only probably got one call.
Well, that's what's interesting is that's not necessarily where realtors are excited to go with their time is work with investors.
No, they're not. And because of, they might have had that or that experience with a particular investor. They didn't say what they said they were going to do.
Yeah.
And maybe the managers of the offices says, no, you need to farm, you need to do this and that. Don't work with investors. But my whole career was, when I was an agent, was only with investors. I never worked with a homeowner.
Yeah. And once again, how you get started sometimes really kind of colors what you think is wise to do. And obviously one thing about investors is that's a multiple transaction is possible with each one of those people.
Right.
Where somebody buys a house is, well, we'll see you, 5 years from now? And that's a big difference.
Yeah. The thing, too, with a real estate agent, once they've worked with a successful investor, like, in fact, the agent that I work with, he won't work with a regular customer because he doesn't want to deal with that. He wants to deal with someone that makes decisions immediately.
And they make them for different reasons. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to go, okay, well, I wish it had a 9-foot ceiling or something ridiculous
right.
like that. You just want to know if the numbers make sense.
Right. There's no emotion on our side.
Right.
When the agent's dealing with me, I don't have to, go get all the family members to look at it. And the decision's made. They like it. They never have to have an open house. I don't think I've ever asked my agent to have an open house. He'd probably laugh at me.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much the way I created my business is I'm working with real estate agents. I passed out those flyers and I followed it up with meetings. I talked at their real estate, their sales
offices,
meetings.
Yeah.
Their office meetings. And, 40, 50 agents there. Maybe you just find one that's somewhat interested in talking with you. And then you can show them the history like you did where they've made hundreds of thousands off of you. And that gets them a little excited. And just really sort of train them. Because every agent I've ever worked with, I train them on how to work with an investor. They already know how to work with a customer that as a homeowner. But they don't know how to work with an investor that I've seen.
What do you think is the difference between the two? In other words, there are successful agents. That's what they do. They deal with owner-occupants, period. What's the difference? Makeup of the person that says, I'd rather be the agent that does with the investor?
I think, again, there isn't any emotion, especially with me. I spend more time buying a hat for myself than a house, so there's really not much emotion to it. but with the home, and a lot of the agents, they probably wouldn't even walk in some of the houses that you and I buy. a typical agent that's out there doing their farms and work in a nice neighborhood and dealing with the family and listing the house and doing their flyer and that type of thing. But to get down and dirty and go look at houses where you're really afraid to walk in them, it takes a special person to look at this type of a house and be able to figure the numbers out with the investor and say this is good or not.
Well, actually, especially since you do this from a distance. Now, where do you live right now?
Park City, Utah.
Most of the time you live there?
Park City, yeah.
Okay.
That's my only house that I live in.
And has that put a dent in your buying ability?
Actually, my best year in my history was 2010, and I was living in Park City full time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, most people are absolutely enthralled with that because they're local trying to do it really well, and you're doing it from a distance with a team.
Well, I'm doing it with a team, and I'm really specific about my areas. In fact, I had a call on a house in San Bernardino yesterday. And it's really not my area because I have to ask a whole lot of questions as what is it worth and how's the neighborhood? And I just don't want to spend the time to do that. And I can't do it from Park City.
Right.
I have agents that in Park City that I play tennis with, and they want me to flip in Salt Lake. And they says, wow, you do all those houses. Why don't you buy here in Salt Lake? And I says, well, I have no clue about Salt Lake because when they call up and tell me about a house on a street, I have no idea what the value is. I don't know what it's going to cost to fix it. I just have no clue. When Riverside, when that agent calls me and tells me a street again, I
probably owned one on the street already.
Probably owned it again, and I know exactly what the value is going to be, and I know how much it's going to cost because I've been dealing with the same contractor for 10 years. So it's really simple. It's not a...
Yeah. Somebody hearing the story would think, okay, he's really delegating a lot, but the truth is you really have an awful lot of personal knowledge that get you 90% there before you have to rely on someone in your team to fill in the gap.
Yeah. Well, the team that I work with is, for example, the agent that I work with, when he calls and tells me a house is worth 185, I know that it's worth 185. I never will deal with an agent or somebody that says, I think you could probably get around 190 to 200.
Right.
As soon as they start talking like that, you really need to sit them down and say, I don't need this spread. This is what I think you can sell it for.
Yeah.
Because if you're making $20,000 on a house and they tell you the spread is $10,000, that's 50% of your profit. So you can't do that. And most of my sales prices are literally within a few thousand of what I thought. It's not 10 or 20 or 30,000 off.
I think what's so important about that is this is a competitive market. So your spread can't be that big because you'd have somebody else competitively bidding against you that knew exactly what it was worth, and their bid would be tighter than yours. Yes. Or your profit would disappear completely, and that gets old pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, the competitive thing, I hear that all the time about competition. I've never worried about competition. And I think I've talked about that in the past, too, is when people say, well, what do you think about the future? And what do you think about what Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac's going to do? And what do you think about Greece? And again, I really don't care. And another thing, when an agent says, well, if you hold on to this for a year, it should be worth $20,000 more. If I listen to all that, you know, I don't care what a year is. My whole time in 2010 was 89 days. So I care what's happening in the next 90 days. 2011, I'm a little nervous. It went up to about 104 days. So again,
you messed up.
6 months from now or a year, it doesn't matter. You know, who cares? You know, I just want to know what the price is today.
Are you typically buying something at this point that is owned by a lender?
Lender.
Okay. So short sale is not a big piece of it?
I think I've probably only bought maybe 2 short sales my whole career.
Okay.
Yeah. 2 or 3 at the most.
Now, there's some markets, and 85 to 89 would have been one of them. There wasn't a lot of lender-owned stuff. So then it's privately owned stuff?
Well, privately owned is when I used to have some ladies that worked for me, and they were like bird dogs, and they followed the notice of defaults and the trustee sales. That was more in the early 90s. The 80s were VA and HUD repos, the late 80s. 87, 89, 88, 89, a lot of VA repos.
Really? Even at the strength of that market, you had VA repos that were in pretty good quantity.
Yeah, 87, 88, 89.
Okay.
Yeah. That's when they were paying that 7% commission. They were trying to get rid of them.
Yeah, I thought I know they had a bunch of them in 84, but I didn't know they had them all the way to 88, 89.
Well, I was looking
the wrong place.
I bought my first one in 86.
Okay.
My first VA repo.
And then bought the heck out of them for years.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
That was my first.
See, I missed that whole thing.
Well,
I was running an ad saying I buy houses.
I buy houses. I've never ran that ad. I've never had an I buy houses ad, and I've never put a sign up on a telephone pole.
Yeah, you miss a lot of fun, man. Not the most efficient way sometimes. As a matter of fact, it's a good way to understand trends because your calls change.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing very well, you know, between, let's say, 86 and 90, and then all of a sudden the calls tripled, but no one had equity. I was almost in the counseling business.
Yeah.
You know, I owe 130 and the house is only worth now 95. What can I do? You know, it's like, oh my gosh. You know, you have a day's worth of that, you're about ready to,
yeah,
you know.
Well, my whole business, again, when I worked in the corporate world, I was in the management position. And so I really delegated a lot. And so I used that in my real estate business for like going out and knocking on doors. I did it maybe 2 or 3 times. And then I trained some people to do it. My training was like a whole maybe 3 door knocking, but it worked. And I had a couple ladies that's all they did was knock on notice of default and trustee sale doors and told them they had a real estate investor was interested in buying. Would you like to talk to them? And so they would set up the appointments. They would tell me what the people owed. They had a little form they filled out. And so when I walked in, I knew what if they had a first, second trustee. I'd done my comps, figured out what it was worth. And then I went in and try to put a deal together.
Okay.
But I actually never really went out and did it.
Okay. You sort of had a team that kind of broke the ice and that
yes.
kind of thing.
Right.
Do you feel that, was that a fairly successful way to do it when you compare it to the other effort of dealing with VAs and stuff?
Yes. Well, the VAs did die up, you know, like 89 or 90, wherever they died up is when I started another system.
Okay.
I just didn't keep trying to do the same one if there wasn't any.
But in 2000 and say 6, well, prior to that, 2000 to 2006, now there were very little REOs. And so VAs or whatever, that was non-existent. Yeah. But you were doing it still out of the MLS.
I was buying out of the MLS. I've always bought out of the MLS. That's always there.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. The MLS is really, really good deals, and people just don't get it yet. For example, while I just got from a long vacation, I was gone a couple months,
right.
Went to the Far East and Australia, And while I was gone, I told my contractor, hey, I'm going to be gone and I'm going to let you buy my deals while I'm gone. And he bought four when I was gone. And one of them here in Riverside, great neighborhood, he bought a house for $70,000 under market value out of the MLS.
Okay. Now, let's talk about that for a minute. Was that negotiated from a bigger price or did somebody price it pretty low to begin with?
Well, the reason why I'm bringing that up is because when there was no REOs and I was buying out of the MLS and the market was going up drastically every month, you know, and people were saying there's no way you can buy great deals in the MLS. And you always can due to errors by agents. Mm-hmm. And this particular error was about 400 square feet on the square footage of the house.
Okay.
They, you know, they turned in their BPO and it was 400 square feet off and it was priced accordingly.
Right.
And it's there. It's a finished bonus room. It's a typical builder that had a big bonus room that could have been finished or not. And a lot of times they got finished and it was never caught in the building permits or what and put up, updated with the MLS or mm-hmm. whatever. So that's an example of a great deal just because of input error. And when the prices were going up in 2003, 4, and 5, and 6, and they were going up drastically at that time, the errors were made by opinion of value by the real estate agent. And so houses were listed when or what they should have been. And I was buying houses at that time. And plus, they were going up $10,000 a month.
Right. Yeah. So it's hard to make a mistake.
Yeah,
actually.
You couldn't make mistakes. So that was the... So there's always different reasons why you can always buy in the MLS.
I think part of it is you know that that's true and your agent knows it's true. There's an expectation that this is going to work. I think that comes across to whoever's got the listing. Do you think that's true?
Yes.
I really do. I think there's if there's expectation that this is a stupid offer and, man, I don't know, I'm embarrassed to present it, that comes across too.
Yes.
And they don't get their share.
And some don't even want to submit it.
They get embarrassed.
They get embarrassed and, you know, it's, again, I don't know why they get embarrassed. It's an unemotional thing. They don't own the house. You know, let's just present the offer.
And usually now it's not even owned by a human being. On the other side, it's a bank. And that's, you know, one of the things that we have about this cycle is you're not usually dealing with a human being that's got a loss at stake. It's a lender.
Right.
That's a big difference in a way. I remember an example talking about somebody being embarrassed. I had a listing that I gave to a guy named Dave Cooley, who used to be a big realtor in Grand Terrace. And he had an offer from an investment company. And what he didn't realize was within about a week of him getting this listing, I had a chance to buy a big 5-bedroom house for $76,000. And I was going to sell, if I sold that house and one other house I owned, I could pay for it cash.
Right.
But I needed to do it quick. Well, he had this offer from a big company, and he was embarrassed to tell me about it. So it took him 3 days to finally work up the courage over the phone to apologize for the offer. And there was a pause, and I said, well, Dave, I said, not only will I take that offer, I'd like the same offer on my residence, and we'll do both of them. And this guy almost fell off his chair, but he didn't realize my circumstances had changed. I had a profit motive to say yes to do two discounted deals.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that most investors never realize is Ben Gay III actually has a great sales book. But one of the things he says is, would you own one? Would you do this yourself? And there's times where I would say, absolutely. Right. You know, the offers that we're making that are all cash, that are simple and all that, yeah, absolutely. I'd say yes to that as opposed to doing what normally has to be done to sell a house.
Right.
And, you know, that's the thing that's not a secret to someone like you and me is that we go through the sales process and we know that that's not a fun journey to do the normal retail sale.
Right. Well, and the reason why you did those, it was opportunity money. You know, you're willing to give up $10,000 or $15,000 on the one side because you're making $50,000 on the other side.
That's right. And
stubborn about the $10,000.
what seemed like a big discount really was a big profit center. And as a matter of fact, important because I had to get a bigger house with another bedroom to adopt my daughter. And see all that. Yeah. You don't know sometimes what's going on the other side.
No, you don't.
Well, Bill, we've ended our first half of the interview. We're going to do this again for next week. Bill, thanks for joining us, and it's been very enjoyable.
All right, thanks for having me.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.